Now I'm going to shift gears to the Firefly cloak. And I'm going to start from the very beginning, so you don't have to know anything at all. And you can just sit back and enjoy it, I hope. The night before she lost her mama, Tessa Lee camped out in a two-room tent with her mama, her little brother Travis, and a crooked-nosed man named Goose. Goose had picked them up that morning at a grocery store in South Hibiscus and loaded their bags into the back of his pickup while her mama gave Tessa Lee a shove into the cab. When Travis was settled beside her, and when her mama had rooted in and slammed the door, Goose said, "Let's skedaddle," and they rattled through the parking lot, waving goodbye to the old men who sat out front on benches and waited for the ice cream truck. It was the first time Tessa Lee'd ever heard that word, skedaddle, and she sang it over and over to a tune she made up herself. She sang it to Travis and grabbed at his pudding belly and made him laugh until her mama told her to quit. "Shan't bother me," Goose said, but Tessa Lee shut up anyway. She couldn't stop singing it in her head, though. As they bumped their way out of town, Tessa Lee studied the rearview mirror and the dusty ghost poofing up behind them. "Skedaddle, skedaddle," she mouthed to the ghosts. They'd left behind her bicycle and her Weebles, her Spirograph and her books. Her mama had said she wouldn't need toys while she was on vacation, but as they drove along hot roads that faded into wavy black seas, it seemed strange to Tessa Lee that she'd be going on vacation with a man she'd never met before. He was friendly enough and let her steer for a long time in Alabama, but while Travis was steering, she turned around and saw that the wind had blown over a bag of her clothes. Her winter coat had spilled out, and the furry hood shivered like a kitten against the tailgate. Tessa Lee shivered too, in spite of the thick heat, and said to her mama, "Must be going on vacation in the North Pole if I'm gonna need my fur coat when I get there." And Tessa Lee's mama shook her head and lit another smoke. "Smart girl," Goose said. "She's smart, she'll quit sassin'," her mama replied. But Tessa Lee could tell she wasn't mad, just worried. She could see worry in the way her mama tapped that cigarette at the edge of the windowsill, trying to keep the ashes neat and short and manageable, not a bit like laid-back Goose, who let his ashes grow long and fade to white, then drop down warm onto his hairy belly. Goose listened to country and sang with all the yodelers and told stories about going on alligator hunts when he was a boy. After a while, Travis fell asleep, and when they stopped for gas somewhere in Tennessee, Tessa Lee's mama was left holding him while Tessa Lee went in the store to help Goose tote out the yoo-hoos. When the man behind the counter said, "Your little girl's gonna be a heartbreaker," Goose said, "Already is," and winked at Tessa Lee, and she trotted out proud with the drinks and decided it wouldn't be so bad to have a daddy named after a bird. "Gotta gear down," Goose said as they went up a hill, and by then they were in the mountains and gearing down a lot. Tessa Lee adjusted her legs so that he could work the gear shift. The backs of her thighs sweated against the vinyl seat, and when she tried to move them, a little bit of her skin got pinched in a place where the seat had cracked and the foam poked through. Goose jiggled gears against the insides of her knees, and Tessa Lee looked at her mama, who took tiny, quiet gasps of air and twiddled her fingers through Travis's curls until his head looked like 100 black fins. They stopped again at a truck stop off a busy highway, a bright yellow building where they sold ponchos and fireworks and bumper stickers that Tessa Lee wasn't allowed to read. Her mama yanked her away from the stickers and paid for their bags of barbecue potato chips along with some handy wipes for the truck. When they got back out, Goose had moved the truck to the rear of the building behind three big metal dumpsters that sat there like a row of rhinoceroses minus their horns. He was changing the license plates. "What do we need new license plates for?" Tessa Lee asked. "Shh," he said, then whispered, "We in a new state, gotta have new plates." Then he looked at her mama and said, "Load 'em up, Sheila." "Come on," her mama said, but Tessa Lee was already hunched down next to Goose. "These plates aren't new," she said. "Sure they are," Goose answered, looking over his shoulder and then giving all four screws another quick twist. "They new to us. Hop on in the truck now, we gotta scoot." So Tessa Lee climbed inside, and soon they were on the road, the red line of the speedometer climbing up to the middle, then pointing all the way to her mama's bony knees. She thought about those license plates as she ate her chips, then while she sucked the barbecue powder off her fingers and nibbled the orange outlines from the edges of her nails. She thought about those plates all splattered up with bug bits, little flecks of bugs from faraway places. Finally, she asked her mama, "What did you do with our old license plates?" Her mama sighed and said, "Honey, Goose just swapped plates with somebody headed for where we came from. Now their license plates will match where they're going, and ours will match where we're going." "We going to Massachusetts?" Tessa Lee asked. "Absolutely," said Goose. That night at the state park campground, they built a fire and had hot dogs without buns and then marshmallows, and her mama said, "Isn't this fun?" And Travis laughed and ran around spitting on ant beds. He had marshmallow on his face and the dirt stuck to it and gave him a little gritty beard. When Tessa Lee pointed it out, everybody laughed, even the couple at the next campsite with just a one-room tent. Goose dug through a cooler and handed her mama a beer. Tessa Lee cut her eyes and said, "You promised." But her mama looked away and said, "We on vacation." Then she popped the tab and made the beer hiss. Even after Tessa Lee and Travis were inside the tent, trying to sleep with a mess of mosquitoes and no-see-ums, Tessa Lee listened for the hissing of beers, one after the other. And then it was late, but too hot to sleep. Travis was asleep, but not Tessa Lee. His diaper needed changing, but the diapers were out in the truck, and Tessa Lee's mama and Goose were whispering and laughing in a way that let her know she shouldn't go out there. Then they moved to the tent, and Tessa Lee thought she should go get a diaper, but Goose and her mama were rustling the walls, so she decided to be still and keep her eyes closed. She'd never been in a tent before, much less a two-room tent, but she wished the walls were thicker and didn't flutter so much. She kept her eyes closed tight and listened to the swishing walls and the smacky mouth noises, wet and sticky, and she told herself that Goose was just eating blueberries. It sounded like blueberries popping into his mouth, squishy as he sucked on them, and she wondered where they'd gotten blueberries from and why nobody'd offered her any. The next day, when she woke up, her mama was gone, and Goose was gone, and the truck was gone. She thought at first that Travis was gone too, but then she saw him wandering around a couple of campsites over, and when she got there, he was licking a pine tree. "Get your mouth off that tree," she said, and slapped him easy like her mama would do. "I like how tree tastes," Travis said, and kept on licking. He was wearing gray shorts over his diaper, a clean one, but no shirt. Somebody had written a phone number on his back in big black magic marker letters. Tessa Lee looked at the number and didn't know at first what it meant. She took his hand and led him back to the tent and found a box of Cheerios beside their bags of clothes. "Is that your phone number?" asked the woman at the next campsite. "Whose number is that?" "I don't know," Tessa Lee said. "Maybe it's the place where Mama and Goose went for breakfast. Probably wanted me to call when we woke up." But she knew they weren't coming back. They'd skedaddled without her. The clothes in the bags belonged to her and to Travis. Her mama's clothes weren't there. Her mama's clothes had been packed in a duffel bag with the word Foxy written in rhinestones on the side, and the duffel bag was gone. The only thing she'd left behind was the two-room tent and her firefly cloak, which Tessa Lee and Travis had used for covers the night before. Tessa Lee put it on over her pajamas and didn't worry too much about dragging it through the dirt. A security guard sat with them at a picnic table and waited, and then a police officer came and a nice woman who drew hopscotch squares on the ground for nobody to jump in. Travis went inside the tent and cried until the policeman let him blow the siren on his car. Tessa Lee just paced around the campsite looking for a note that might have blown away in the wind. There wasn't any wind to speak of, but she thought maybe it had been windy before she woke up, and she checked the back of a BB bat wrapper she found in the grass, and she studied a receipt half burned in the fire pit, but there were no words from her mama. Finally, her grandparents drove up in a white van, but since Tessa Lee didn't know yet who they were, she most certainly did not go hug their necks or try to pet the little dog who hung his head out the window and yowled. She wrapped the cloak tight around her and sucked on a strand of her hair, and when the woman who turned out to be her granny asked if she knew where her mama was headed, she didn't mention anything about Massachusetts. So that's the opening sequence of the book. Thank you. And that's your basic setup to the book. You know, as a writer, one of my goals, probably my biggest goal, is to grow in my craft and to stretch myself with everything I do. And it's a nice way to think, because that way, if you write a novel that fails, it doesn't really matter. You can just go, well, I stretched in my craft, you know, or whatever. So anyway, but that is my intention. And until this point, everything that I have published had been written in first person so that I was speaking through the mouth of a character from one person's perspective. And in this piece, I'm in third person, so I'm close to the character, sometimes right in their thoughts, but I also back up sometimes and can look at them more objectively. And I also wrote from three different characters' perspectives in this book. So that opening section really could have been called a prologue, because the very next sentence is 7 years later, when she finally found her mama, she wasn't in New England after all. She'd been living 2 hours away all that time, up the beach just 2 hours, and never coming to a single dance recital or ball game. Okay, so we jump 7 years right there. And I tell the story from Tessa Lee, from her mother Sheila, who abandoned her, and from the grandmother Lil, who raised her. And I really wanted to look at, I wanted to get into three different characters' perspectives. And most importantly, I think I wanted, and I hope that I have shown the full humanity of these characters. That's really my intention, because Tessa Lee's mother is a drug addict and a sex worker. And it's real easy to go, ooh, you bad abandoning drug addict sex worker mother. Bad person. And that's exactly what I want to get away from, because you don't just one day end up being that. There's a much bigger story. And so what I wanted to do is to hold the horror of what she did, at the same time, hold the circumstances that led her to those choices. So I try to do that for all the characters. This is an interesting one for me because Tessa Lee, who is 15 for the rest of the book, was the most difficult character to write because she hasn't lived long enough to really mess up. Not too bad, anyways. So in terms of complexity, she's not as interesting to me, although I hope I did all right by her. So I'm going to read you the section. I'm going to read you three more sections. I'm going to read you Tessa Lee finding her mother. I'm going to read you a short section from her mother. She's hard to read early on because she's hallucinating a lot, but it's kind of fun. And then I'm going to read you a grandma section so that you get a sense of all these characters, and I hope you get a sense of the book. The only thing you really need to know is that Tessa Lee has run away from home to find her mother. She had a good lead. She finds her. And when she gets there, though, she is badly sunburned. You'll need to know that later, because she wasn't thinking about how it would be to walk for a long time looking for her mother. It was her mama, all right. Tessa Lee recognized her right away. She had long dark hair with loose waves like Tessa Lee's hair and very round hazel eyes like Tessa Lee's eyes, but she was really skinny with collarbones that scooped in and made moats around her neck. Tessa Lee put her face up close to the glass and stared until a breathy voice said, "Welcome to Fantasies of the Boardwalk. Buy your ticket at the booth to your left." Guess I better stop and tell you what her mama's doing. She's working in a boardwalk attraction as a mermaid in a conch shell. She's in a picture window, okay? So that's where she is. So Tessa Lee's face is up next to this window where she sees her mother, and her mother says, "Welcome to Fantasies of the Boardwalk. Buy a ticket at the booth to your left." Her voice didn't sound quite real. It sounded like a bird imitating her mama. Her mama was dressed like a mermaid, reclining in a conch shell, but she was shrunken, not full size. The conch shell itself was just a little larger than a baby's cradle, and her mama was small enough to fit inside it. She didn't look much bigger than a baby or a doll. Tessa Lee wondered what it would feel like to hold her. "Welcome to Fantasies of the Boardwalk," her mama repeated. "Buy a ticket at the booth to your left." Tessa Lee watched her mouth move and saw that she was actually speaking. It wasn't a recording, but there was something wrong with her teeth. They didn't fit. They were too big for her mouth. They pushed her lips out a smidgen too far to be her mama's lips. Her mama's long legs were missing too, hidden somewhere beneath the blue-green tail that draped over the side of the conch shell and arched gracefully into a perfectly useless fin. Her bra was made of shells, maybe cockle shells, and Tessa Lee stared at her small breasts, her tan skin, her long brown arms, at the slight wrinkles at the base of her neck. Her mama sighed and said, "Girl, are you going to buy a ticket or just stare at me all day? You act like you've never seen a mermaid before." It was the same voice that might have said, "Girl, are you going to pick up those blocks or leave them scattered all over the floor?" And something in Tessa Lee's chest broke open and spread out warm. "I'm sorry," she said. "I haven't had a lot of experience with mermaids." She could tell now that the conch shell was made of plastic, that it was like a bed, like the spaceship bed Travis had looked at over and over in the mail order catalog. Pop Pop wouldn't buy it because there wasn't enough room in the mobile home for a bed with a pointy nose. A man in flip-flops carrying a little girl on his shoulders edged up to the window. The child pointed and laughed, and while her mama told them where to buy their tickets, Tessaly noticed that there were crabs crawling around the bottom of the fake conch shell. She couldn't tell if they were real. They looked real, but it was hard to be sure. They might be wind-up crabs, like bathtub toys. She went to the ticket counter where a man, eyes closed, was bobbing his head to music only he could hear. Tessaly knocked on the glass, startling him, and she bought a ticket and strolled through the museum. She was the only patron in those stuffy dark halls. She looked for an inside view of her mama while she worked up the nerve to tell her who she was. She saw wax renditions of a famous clown and some old movie stars, and she saw the characters from a cartoon she used to watch with Travis. She could see rough edges on the edge of every figure, like nobody bothered to scrape off the extra wax when the figure came out of its mold. Tessaly made candles with her granny to sell at craft fairs, and she knew how important the small details could be. Here, nobody seemed to care, and on top of that, there was no sign of her mama. So she went back to the picture window, where the mermaid said, "Welcome to Fantasies of the Boardwalk. Buy your ticket at the booth to your left," like she'd never seen Tessaly before in her life. Tessaly looked around, and since nobody else was there, she said, "Mama, it's me, Tessaly." The mermaid peered out from her conch shell with empty round eyes while the crabs clicked around on the floor. Tessaly held her breath and tried to swallow past her heart, which had made it up as far as her throat. "Remember? You left me and Travis 7 years ago," she said. "You left with Goose." "I don't know nobody named Goose," the mermaid said sharply now. But she looked like she might cry, like her mouth was about to crumple. Her teeth nudged out past her pout, her all wrong teeth. Tessaly studied her about to crumple face and her hair, which sat cock-sided on her head. Her mama was wearing a wig. "Sheila Birch," Tessaly asked, "that's your name, right?" "I don't go by that name," the mermaid whispered. "I'm on the clock," she said. "You gotta go." She looked confused, her eyes darting every which way. "You gotta come home," Tessaly said. "Something bad's happened." She wanted to tell her about Travis and how he died, but she couldn't, not when her mama was wearing a costume. "Shh," the mermaid shushed. "I don't know you." She adjusted her shoulders and jabbed at one of the shells of her bra, and Tessaly wondered if she had anything underneath that shell at all. Maybe the mermaid wasn't her mama. Maybe she wasn't real. The mermaid composed her face, sat up taller, and gave her shoulders a wiggle. "I can't have children," she said. "All my children are fish." And then she laughed a startling laugh, too loud for someone so shrunken, too rich. The sound was completely familiar, and Tessaly could feel her face get hot. She touched her cheeks and her nose, and she could feel tiny blisters from her sunburn breaking, damp on her fingers as she rubbed them away. Her whole face was wet with sweat and blisters, and she couldn't breathe. "Mama," she said, "please." And she took off her backpack and pulled out the firefly cloak, hoping it would help her remember, because maybe her mom had been in an accident and had amnesia, and that's why she'd never come back. Tessaly held it up for her mama to see. "Look," she said, and then she put on the firefly cloak, which fit her perfectly by then. It was a faded navy blue velvety robe with tiny gold fireflies glowing all over it. Some of them were so gold they almost looked green, and when she put up her arms, the fabric made wings. Just putting it on made Tessaly feel stronger, gave her something to cloak herself with, and made her feel safe. But her mama sucked in a deep gasp, and when she let it out, she cried, "No!" long and hard. It was almost a shriek, almost a wailing. In an instant, there were people around Tessaly on the boardwalk, tourists and shopkeepers and the guy from the hot dog cart across the street, watching the mermaid, who kept crying. She put both hands on her face and wiped backwards from her eyes until she'd pushed the wig far enough for everyone to see her bleached hair frizzing yellow beneath it. She smeared her mascara in thick swoops, and Tessaly was ashamed to see her like that. People swarmed around the window, and one woman tapped on the glass and said, "Easy, honey," and tried to calm her mama down as Tessaly backed to the edges of the crowd. Then a door opened from the side of the wax museum, and a man with thick gold chains around his neck and hair like a rusty Brillo pad sauntered up to the window and said, "What the hell's the matter with you?" He looked official. He had a cell phone on his belt and a knife in a little holster with a swinging golden chain. Her mama kept gasping like she was choking. She looked a little like her granny right after Travis died, when she got too worked up and Rosie Joe had to put a paper bag over her nose to keep her from hyperventilating. Her mama kept shaking her head, wheezing, "No, no," her voice already hoarse. The guy from the hot dog cart pointed to Tessaly and said, "That gal right there's the one who riled her up, Reggie." "Her?" the man asked, and Tessa Lee looked away and started stuffing this Firefly cloak back into her backpack. She wanted to run, but she hadn't even told her mama about Travis. Yeah, the hot dog guy said. I saw her. She was doing some kind of voodoo or something, whispering, putting on a robe. The zipper on her backpack got caught in the fabric, and Tessa Lee forced it, blushing, trying not to look at all, at the people who were looking at her, puzzled and accusing. What are you harassing my employees for? Reggie asked. Get out of here, you little punk. And he took a step toward Tessa Lee like he was running her off, like she was a raccoon in his garbage. But before Tessa Lee had a chance to bolt, her mama let out another big cry, and she couldn't just leave with her mama crying. Holy shit, the guy from the hot dog cart said and laughed, and Reggie shook his head like nothing in the whole world made sense. He grabbed Tessa Lee by the arm, and when he did, her mama howled again. She tried to yank her arm away. She almost yelled out, Travis got killed. But that seemed like the wrong way to break the news, especially when her mama was already so upset. And besides that, she didn't want to say Travis's name out loud if her mama was just going to deny she knew him. Before she had a chance to do anything, Reggie shouted back to the mermaid, straighten up in there, I mean it. Cut off the light and go clean up your face. And in a flash, just that fast, the picture window went dark inside. The mermaid disappeared, and Tessa Lee missed her opportunity. People on the boardwalk oohed and laughed and began to disperse. Tessa Lee tried to wiggle her arm away, but the man grabbed her tighter. You're hurting me, she said, not quietly. You shut up, he said under his breath, and he pulled her down the block, his fingers tight on her arm. Let me go, Tessa Lee demanded. That's my mama. I've got to talk to her. Reggie paused, looked down at her, and laughed. He had on sunshade, so she wasn't sure where he was looking, but she thought he might be looking at her breasts. You can't talk to her now, he replied, but he relaxed his grip a little. They turned the corner and moved toward an amusement park. I got a business to run, he said. Can't have any whacked out mermaids screaming at the customers, you understand? But she's my mama, Tessa Lee insisted. There was bile in her throat. Her heart was rising, fluttering. Whether she is or whether she ain't, she's on the job right now, the man said. Tessa Lee clenched her teeth to keep from crying. I've waited a long time to see her, she whispered. Then she tightened every muscle and pulled herself into the darkness at her center, where none of it could touch her, where there was no need to give up anything because there was nothing else to lose. The man with his fingers still clamping her arm said, she gets off at 11. You can talk to her then, but I don't want to see you back on this block before. You hear me? When Tessa Lee didn't reply, he grabbed her chin and held it up, and he pulled his face down close to her, so close she could see the clogged black pores on his nose. You hear me? He repeated. If I see your face again around here before 11, I'll call somebody to come get you. Or better yet, might put you to work for me. He leaned down, kissed her on the mouth, and then swatted her hard on her bottom. You mark my word. He left her next to a trailer stand where girls dressed up as belly dancers made jewelry out of gold chains. The chains were on spools that they pulled out like thread. They said, hey, Reggie, and he said, hey, ladies, and walked away. Tessa Lee started walking in the other direction. She didn't have anywhere to go, but that didn't stop her. She wiped her mouth off hard with the back of her hand and marched on. Sheila Birch had $81 in her pocket when she flagged down a taxi on the highway at 10:45. She'd left work early, even before Sophie'd arrived to take her place. She'd crawled out of her room full of mirrors, mirrors angled in 1,000 directions to make her look tiny and frame her in a shell. She'd loosened the corset of the mermaid's tail on her own and thrown it over a chair in the dressing room, then changed clothes quickly and left through the back without even clocking out. She didn't want Reggie to know, not until she'd had time to get away. She cut through the alley and across the parking lot of the Pancake House. She didn't want to be seen, and she didn't want to be found. Where to? The cab driver asked her. Anywhere, she said and laughed. Loop the city and tie a knot in it, a strong knot so it can't wiggle out. I'm going to need a deposit, the driver said, so Sheila tossed him a 20 and stretched out in the back. She watched the lights pass by, neon and halogen street lights, traffic lights, the spotlight outside a dance club, a sea of lights. Sheila was underneath them. In the back seat of the cab, at the bottom of that sea, somewhere out there she had a daughter, a fish child in a firefly cloak. She was high and she was drowning. It felt good for a while, and then it didn't. Take me home, she said to the cabbie. Lady, I don't know where that is. Why don't you sit up and tell me? I can't, Sheila answered. She burrowed into the vinyl of the seat's back and closed her eyes tightly so it would be dark for a minute. But when she looked at the dark, she saw fireflies lighting up and flickering, sneaking up on her and glowing. The fireflies mocked her and made her feel sick. I better sit up, she said, and she did. Something was clotting inside her mouth, so she went through her bag looking for gum. But then the light caught her eyes again. She looked up at the light and then down in her bag, and all she could see were fireflies, so she gave up on the gum and tried to rest. Sheila was drowning in the lights, but she was a mermaid, so she knew it'd be okay. All she had to do was swim away. The cabbie's voice kept calling her back. Lady, you're not ODing, are you? You want me to take you to the hospital? No, she insisted. In her ears, her voice sounded far away and small. I need more money, the cabbie said, or I'll have to put you out. Sheila wadded a 20 into a loose ball and threw it over the seat. I need an address, he said. Sheila tried to remember where she wanted to go. Not back to the wax museum. She couldn't go there anymore. The girl would keep looking. Not to the apartment. Reggie'd find her there. Where do you live at? The cabbie asked. Way out of town, Sheila said. Take a left. Buy a ticket at the booth to your left. The driver threw up both hands and said, Aye, why are you doing this to me, lady? I'm sorry, Sheila said, and she tried to reach over and put her hand on the driver's shoulder to give him a squeeze, but she missed and squeezed his headrest. Turn right up there. See that road? Right up there. She pulled another bill from her pocket and tossed it toward the driver. This one fluttered gently, then caught a current from the AC vent and blew over to the passenger seat. The driver turned west and kept going. Sheila threw her last dollar into the air to watch it fly. I used to live in a swayback house, she said, and settled against the seat. It pleased her to remember that. It sounded perfect, the perfect answer to every question, though she wasn't sure what it meant. You are one messed up chick, the cabbie said. You got a driver's license? Show me your ID. But Sheila ignored him. She was following the lights to the swaybacked house that she could picture in her mind. She knew if she could get back there, everything would be okay. Nothing would turn out the way it had if she could just get back to the swaybacked house. She could undo it all once she got there. Then she was crying at the memory of that house. The roof was sunken in the middle, arched in from the weight of something, snow that didn't melt for a long time, the awful weight of winter. She always expected the roof to collapse, to fall in on her, but something kept it intact. A vine grew inside that house, twining up from the ground and supporting the whole thing. It was dark inside and damp, and ferns grew in the corners, and all the walls were soft, so soft you could leave your fingerprints there. It didn't collapse. The vine held it up, and from the outside, at the very front where the rafters met in a perfect A, the vine burst forth, green, with soft red tubular flowers. Take me to the swaybacked house, Sheila muttered. I used to live in a swaybacked house, but now I can't find it. Lady, sit up, the driver said. I used to live in a swaybacked house, she sang, and then she was rocking in the back seat of the cab, or maybe they were going down a dirt road, a bumpy road. They were out in the country, on the way home. When she got home, she'd be safe, like a fern, protected by dense, cool shade. The lights were already gone, no more lights, just a serene darkness. She was going to the place before fireflies. And then she got sick. The great wash of her mistakes, all of them, came rushing out, sour years and decisions dripping from the seat, running in the grooves of the floor mats. Damn it, the cabbie said, yo, crackhead, and he hit the brakes. I try to be good to you and look what I get. I should have took you to the police. Now get out. I'm sorry, Sheila said, but she wiped her mouth hard with the back of her hand and said, you got me home. Thank you. They were nowhere at all. There was nothing around but some woods and a ditch. The driver said, you know, I'm doing you a favor, leaving you here. If I took you to the police station, they'd throw you in the can. This is exactly where I wanted to go. Do I owe you more money? Nah, he said, you're paid up. Good, she said, because I'm out of money. And she laughed. The driver shook his head. Listen, he said, the road's not too far back that away. And he pointed from where they'd come. Sleep it off. Somebody will give you a lift tomorrow. I'll do that, Sheila said. I'll just sleep it off. She stepped out into the darkness, stumbled just once, and then she set off looking for her swaybacked house. So that's Sheila. Now I'm going to read you Lil. This is the last section. I've jumped to page 71 in my bound galley. I don't have the actual book here. I don't know what page it is in the book, but it's way on up there. I'm jumping ahead to the place where Tessa Lee has made a friend at the beach who actually is kind of like a guardian angel and has taken very good care of her and has helped her to get back in touch with her granny, and her granny has come to pick her up. Tessa Lee has no idea that her mother went off because her mother is now on a path to reconnect with her. It's going to be a long time and it won't be pretty, but that's the path that she's on. But Tessa Lee doesn't have any idea about that. And so Lou has just picked up Tessa Lee and is on the way home with her. And they live in a place called Holly Sanders Mobile City. It's a very high-end trailer park. And it really makes me angry when people talk about trailer park trash, because I don't think that there's any such thing. I think that that's the stereotype. That's what I write against. It's like there's more to it than that. It's way too simple to say somebody's just a drug addict or just a trailer park trash or whatever, you know. So anyway, this is a fine trailer park. Lil never went anywhere without her scissors. And they came in handy just outside the city limits, where she stopped at a roadside nursery and bought an aloe vera plant for Tessa Lee's sunburn. Tessa Lee didn't even protest when Lil told her to get in the back and strip to her underclothes. Lil snipped the speckled green arms right off the plant, pressed the slippery juices out, and doctored Tessa Lee's face and arms and legs. The fluid oozed and spread across her sunburn, thick as egg whites, smearing over blisters. "Sure does stink," Tessa Lee said, groggy. "That little plant just sacrificed its life for you," Lil replied, squeezing the sticky fluid into the scorched part of Tessa Lee's head. "Least you could do is appreciate it." "I appreciate it," Tessa Lee said and yawned, "but it still stinks." There was no back seat in the van because Lil had taken it out so she could haul her supplies and products to craft fairs. But she had an old sleeping bag back there, so Tessa Lee stretched out and went to sleep. She'd been sunburned just that bad on the day when Lil first saw her. She was 8 years old with stringy brown hair cut into a long shag, and her freckled cheeks looked like somebody'd rubbed strawberries all over them. Her nose was hard as a little shrimp shell from all that sun. She was wearing that ridiculous house coat even then, looked like she was playing dress up. She wouldn't take it off for the longest time until she dragged it through a pile of poop left in the yard by accident. "Let me wash it," Lil said, but Tessa Lee wouldn't take it off. "Your lightning bugs got stinky all over them. You don't want to smell like stinky, do you?" Then Lewis had jumped in and said, "Take off that house coat, girl. You got to mind your granny." "It's not a house coat. It's a cloak," Tessa Lee insisted. "And they're fireflies, not lightning bugs." "Okay, then, but they're shitty little fireflies," Lil said. And Tessa Lee laughed suddenly and peeled the house coat off. When it was clean and folded up, she'd asked for a clothes hanger, saying she thought they better put it in the closet in case her mama needed to wear it when she came to get them. A few days later, she asked Lil for a pillowcase and stuffed the lightning bug house coat inside it. That's where it'd been ever since, on Tessa Lee's bed. Not the pillow that she rested her head on, but the one she kept under her arm. And Lil could see it in the rearview mirror that she was using it for a pillow again. While Tessa Lee slept, Lil passed through town after town, little fishing villages and many resorts, singing a song in her head. "Thank you for the valley I walk through today. The darker the valley, the more I learn to pray. I found you where the lilies were blooming by the way. So I thank you for the valley I walk through today." It was an old song from when she was a girl. Back then she went to the country church with her aunt and girl cousins and with the boys before they reached their teenage years and quit. That church didn't have electricity, just fans provided by the funeral home to wave in front of your face while the preacher paced and banged on his pulpit and called on sinners to repent. They didn't sing that song in her new church, but it still rang through Lil's head during troubled times. "Thank you for every hill I climbed, for every time the sun didn't shine. Thank you for every lonely night. I prayed till I knew everything was all right." The problem with that song was that the person who wrote it was already at the top of the hill, out of the rain, up from the valley. It was a lot harder to say thank you when you were in the middle of a mess. Still, she had Tessa Lee with her, and that was a lot to be thankful for. Sometimes singing that song could remind her that she'd get out of the valley one day, and that was enough. Lil passed the place where she and Lewis had gone to a bluegrass festival the year before the children came to live with them, and she passed the road that led to a park where they had an annual craft show. For the past 5 years, she'd sold her wreaths and painted napkin holders there. The toilet paper dolls didn't do so well at that fair, but they were a big hit in North Carolina, where she and Lewis had lived before they moved to Holly Sanders Mobile City. From time to time, Lil's emotions threatened her, like a gang hiding around the corner. They stepped out one at a time, each individual feeling, until there were too many of them to manage, and they backed her against the wall. When she crouched down, they crouched down too. They breathed up all her air. Over the years, she'd learned how to handle them. To keep them away, she had to concentrate on concrete things. What was right in front of her, she had to name it. Billboard for gas station, silo, big field, woods, blue Honda, dead possum, watermelon stand. As long as she concentrated on the facts, the feelings couldn't touch her. She had to be disciplined about it, though. She couldn't indulge any of the feelings, or else she might get swamped with them all. She was naming the details along the highway when she noticed a body of water she'd never seen before, a new sea on that familiar road. But really, it was just a field of tomato beds covered in sheets of polyethylene, shiny in the palest blue. A sea on her left, then a sea on her right, one after the other, and the highway became a bridge as she passed over seas in the middle of fields. How could she name the facts when nothing was what it seemed? Maybe that was why Sheila used drugs, because nothing was the way it seemed anyway. She hadn't slept the night before, and now the whole world seemed strange. She kept picturing red tomatoes beneath the sea, and then she pictured Sheila as a mermaid swimming among them. Sheila'd been a sweet little girl, a loving child who rode on her daddy's tractor and waved as they pulled up at the barn. She'd been a hard-working girl. She'd fill her shirt tails with tomatoes, some of them pink and some of them ripe, and it never mattered anyway, because Lil loved them red and Lewis loved them green, so no matter what Sheila picked, somebody'd always eat it. Stewed tomatoes, tomatoes for cannon, they used them for that too. And Sheila, just a little girl standing on a stool, her arms buried past the elbows in tomatoes, squishing them up, tomato seeds in her hair, splatters of tomato in her eyebrows, working all day long without the first complaint. When she was a little girl, she could do no wrong, but when she was a teenager, Lord God. Now Lil had Tessalie to worry about. Tessalie still had a chance, and Lil had to concentrate on her. It was just as well that Sheila wasn't around. Still, Lil had wanted to send word when Lewis died. She wrote a letter, but there was nowhere to mail it. But Sheila knew where she was, somehow. Somehow she knew their phone number, too, even though they'd moved out of state by then. And she'd written it on Travis's back. Lil'd scrubbed and scrubbed to get that number off. Even after she'd bathed Travis for a month, she could see Sheila's handwriting coming up through his skin. She'd made a line through her seven so nobody would mistake it for a one. And as mad as Lil was about what Sheila'd done, she still found it touching that Sheila'd go to so much trouble. She knew that deep down, Sheila must love those children if she cared about where they wound up. And Sheila must love her a little if she wanted her to raise them. If Lil'd been a really horrible mother, then Sheila might have written somebody else's phone number on Travis's back. After Sheila ran away, Lewis wanted to sell the farm and start up somewhere else. But it took Lil a long time to give it up. She kept thinking Sheila might come home, and she wanted to be there if she did. The last time she saw Sheila, they'd argued. Lil was knitting a skirt for a toilet paper doll, green and white, she remembered, and Sheila pranced into the room with an attitude, telling Lil she was going out, not even asking. "Not on a school night," Lil said. "Yes, I am," Sheila replied. She had both hands on her hips, and Lil remembered seeing her that way and realizing that she actually had hips. It made her mad that Sheila had hips, even though she couldn't help it. "Go to your room," Lil told her. But Sheila just stood there, defying her. Lil kept right on knitting, making the doll's skirt. When she was done, the skinny doll's legs would slide into the toilet paper roll, and the skirt would billow out wide over the toilet tissue and cover up what was private. Her needles clicked hard against each other. "I know who you've been running with," she said, "and I won't have it. Now go to your room." "Mama, I'm going out," Sheila repeated. Lil's stitches were way too tight. She felt her mouth pull in like those stitches, tense. "I won't have it," she said. She didn't look at Sheila. "You're not allowed to see him. I mean it. Not never again." By then, her voice was raised. And by then, Sheila was crying. "But I love him," she said. "You do not love him," Lil shouted. "You're a child. You don't know the first thing about love." Sheila walked over to the door, but didn't step outside it. She stood there with her forehead against the screen, the tears sliding down her cheeks. "Do you want to kill your daddy?" Lil continued. "Do you want him to have a heart attack and die? Because he'll die if I tell him who you're seeing." "Don't you say that," Sheila said, her tears turning to sobs. "It's the truth," Lil said. Her needles clicked furiously. "It'll kill him." "But I love him," Sheila wailed. "Then go be with him," Lil spit. "But if you do, don't you ever come back here again. You hear me? If you leave here right now, I don't never want to see you again. And when the screen door slammed, Lil shouted, "You better get back in this house, Sheila Birch. You better get back right now." But her voice was weak and croaky, like an old woman's voice. The sound of Sheila's sobbing stayed with her as she knitted, sobs ratcheting up, then fading out as Sheila ran down the drive. Lil sat there with her toilet paper doll until she finished the skirt. She concentrated on the green yarn and the white. She counted stitches. She even made a matching hat. And when she was finished, she was an old lady, and her daughter was gone. Too much emotion at one time could do that, could catapult anybody right over midlife and into old age. She could still conjure Sheila's crying. It was a sound that transcended time, and just thinking of it made the goose pimples rise up on her arms. So she had to concentrate on concrete things. Cinderblock Beauty Shop Baptist Church, Cornfield Grammar School. It was late afternoon when Lil got to the turnoff for Holly Sanders Mobile City, but she drove right past it. She drove another half hour before she called Rosie Joe on her cell phone. "I'm taking the long way home," she told her. "How come?" Rosie Joe asked. "Can't get my foot off this gas pedal," she said. "Feed the fish for me. We'll be home tomorrow." When Tessa Lee woke up, Lil just tell her they were lost and they'd get a motel room somewhere. She'd give Tessa Lee the map and let her find the way home. Lil wasn't ready for company. She knew Rosie Joe'd have a cake made, might even string up balloons. And Lil was thrilled two pieces to have Tessa Lee back, but she didn't feel like celebrating. She needed concrete details passing by. Dead raccoon, Georgia pines, bridge over dried up creek bed. She could drive for as long as Tessa Lee could sleep. It'd taken Lil a long time to admit that Lewis wouldn't have cared who Sheila loved. Sheila could have married a sheepdog, and eventually Lewis would have called him son. She was the one whose heart seized up. She was the one who felt like dying. So she ran Sheila off and she shut her out. She concentrated on concrete things, an empty bedroom, an empty mailbox, white paint, white paint, white paint. She painted the whole house, top to bottom, inside and out. And when she was done, she sold it.